Excision number 22114, Reel 3.
Fred Hartle, Reel 3.
Yeah. We did another job, the Captain Skinner, MM, myself, and two more lads were detailed to contact the Canadians, and there was a gap of about 3 to 4 miles. The Canadians were on our right, and the 3rd Division was on the left. And further up, of course, on the coast were the 50th Northumbrian Division. The Canadians were in between, the 3rd Canadian, between the 3rd British Div and the 50th Northumbrian. Our job was to go and locate them and find out what exactly where their positions were. So we set off on bicycles. And we'd gone about halfway and we saw a car. So we got off the bikes, it was dark, we could see it was pretty moonlight night. So we stopped there because we didn't know what it were. And we were there for about half an hour, no movement at all. So it gradually edged its way forward till we could see what it were. And it was a German general halfway out of his car, and his outriders. And his outriders all laid about on motorbikes. They'd been machine gunned apparently by the RAF staffing. And it was a full German general, and he was half out of his staff car. And his outriders had all been caught by the staffing planes, and they were all laid about on the side road. Anyway, when we found out it wasn't an ambush or anything like that, we proceeded and contacted the Germans at a place called Carpicourt. There was an aerodrome there, Carpicourt, and it was half held by the Germans and half held by the Canadians. When we completed that, we returned back to our battalion.
How did you like doing patrolling work?
I got quite good at it. I'm not boasting, but I got quite good. In fact, I became patrol leader. What happened was that Captain Skinner, he'd been doing all the patrol work, and they always selected his men. And I happened to be one of them. Anyway, it was unfortunately that we set off. A machine gun had been spraying C Company, and they had a good location of it. They said they knew exactly where it were. So there were, there were two sections of about five in each. I had one section, and Captain Skinner had the other. So he told me to go out in the afternoon, get as near as I could, and lay down in the corn, out at way, and try not to be observed. It was a crawling job again. We crawled up, and I got about 200 yards up this road and laid in the side. And then he said he'd be there at a certain time, which he did. He arrived at a certain time, and he said, yeah. I said, no, not seen a thing. He said, righto, we'll start moving forward steady. We've gone about another 150 yards, and I thought I'd seen some movement in front. I said, I'm sure I've seen something run across that road up in front. He says, have you? I said, aye. So he said, all right, stop there a bit. Must have been there a good half an hour, probably more. Never moved. They said, all right, we'll move forward again. And we moved forward again, and then we were ambushed. And the lad I was with, he got a bullet in both his ankles, and he couldn't move. And Skipper, we call him, always call him Skipper, he got a burst down his wrist and all like that. This lad was out, he was screaming his head off because he was in so much pain. So I said, there was that much confusion. I said, get on my back and we'll see if we can get out of it. So he got on my back, and I crawled with him about 200 yards. I was exhausted myself by then. And then Germans must have seen it because they were throwing stick grenades, and they were bursting on the roadside and all like that. And then he started firing down the road, and I kept dropping down into a little bit of a ditch. And finally, I got to where we could see the mines. Now, I've got a ladder on my back, and if I tread on them, I'm going to go up. So I said, keep still. I said, don't lose my balance. And I could see where the mines were stuck up. They'd been put across this road and into fields. So I managed to pick my way through. Then I got to a right-hand turn. I went up and I put him behind an embankment. In the meantime, the other lads had got hold of Captain Skinner, brought him back. You were in a bad way. And then C Company Commander Jimmy Gray, C Company was a bloody good lad, Jimmy, he was a major. And he come down and he saw what tacking we were in, on the stretchers, and I never saw Skipper no more after that. And then we were there about a month, still out doing patrol work. And there was another man who used to go out with, a well-known figure. Doing it well. He was an actor. And I'm trying to think of his name. And anyway, a well-known actor, and he took part in a film called Four Feathers. That was 1418 War, I think. And he became our intelligence officer. Oh, Donald Gray, that was his name, Donald Gray. And became a BBC announcer. He'd only got one arm. And he used to debrief us when we come back. And then when we'd done about a month patrolling and going in, we're doing all kinds of scrapes there, we decided we're going to mount an attack on Crown itself. So we're taken out, and another battalion took over from us, and we went to some more places, some high ground overlooking Crown itself. And I was detailed to take a listening patrol down into Caen, not to go into Caen, but onto the outskirts, or take this here listening patrol. And I was told to come back at first light, back into the battalion lines, as they were going to bomb it the following day. And this we did. And then we watched them bomb Caen. We went in immediately after.
What did this bombing of Caen look like?
It was terrible. Terrible. The casualty list must have been enormous. I understand later on that they'd been told to go to a certain area out of the where they likely bombing. But it was just heap of ruins, the area we went. Just heap of ruins. Anyway, we went in, and the first thing I saw was a German armoured car. And it bottled in rubbish, you know, the ruins and all that, and there were slabs of stone and all, and it were fenced in, he couldn't get out, and he's running around in circles. So one of the lads hit him with a pier and knocked him out. And then there's a castle at Caen, still there, and we went in on the right of that and moved into an abbey, I think it was an abbey, that were on fire. And my platoon dug in the abbey grounds. It was all on fire, and we watched as a great big oak beams come crashing down from the top and sent a shower of sparks up, and they were still all on fire. We dug in there for a while, and then we were told to move further inland, further into town centre, and moved in about 200-300 yards. And there were some French resistance men come to us. So they said, we want you to move into town centre. He says, oh, Germans here. The platoon officer said, I can't do that. I work to instructions, so I have to wait for my company commander to tell me. Now, the French were really annoyed about it. So they said, we're not doing it. We have to wait instructions. Anyway, after 2 or 3 hours, we started moving in again, and it was just rubbish, just heaps of rubbish all over the place. And we moved in until we got up towards the river itself. The Germans had retired to the side of the river. And then we handed over Caen to the Canadians, and we marched out and back to a village 3 or 4 miles away. And I think we had some first bath. We didn't have a bath for how long. So we got a bath. They drink some showers up, and we had a bath.
How much resistance did the Germans put up in Caen?
Well, there was a lot of sniping and all like that in the ruins. But these here resistance men were telling the British, you know, what they were. So they were hooking them out, see. And then we were at this here place for a few days rest. And then the troops came with some reinforcements come. And then we were told that we were going to start breaking out to the Pas de Calais. And it was a scheme called Goodwood. We were ferried, some by bus, some by marching, over the bridge that the 6th Airborne had captured. And we started moving a place as if we were going towards north of France. Apparently, it was going to be a big job, because there were thousands of troops all waiting to move. We got into start lines, and there was a big bomber raid. Went in. The target was a place called Troan. And we got to capture this Troan because it was one of the keys. We later learned that the whole idea was to lure the German armour from the American sector round onto the British sector, and therefore weaken the American front so they could go when General Patton made a strike. A lot of the armour had already been switched down onto the British front. Now, Goodwood was a calamity. The bombers went in, and then we followed, and we took quite a number of prisoners. But things were getting harder. He got the high ground. Germans. He got the high ground, and they started the mortaring and the shelling us. And I remember a shower of mortar bombs, called them morning minutes. They landed right among that company as I was with, and I got blown up myself, and I did my ears in there. The eye explosion. I couldn't see a thing, because there was so much dust knocking about. Anyway, we carried on, and we captured quite a number of key positions, but we didn't get thrown. We were still advancing on it, and still had the high ground. And we got within about 200 or 300 yards of the Troan village itself and the railway, and they opened up with machines. Must have had massive machine guns. Machine guns opened up, and we lost 152 men in the first 24 hours. I remember one lad. I'd got it back in a building. One of these here, you know, with cattle. Cattle go in the winter, you know. And you got a little weather vane on top. When they go in with the cattle goes in out that way, you know. Anyway, I got up behind one of them, and I saw this lad to my right, and he could see what was happening. They were all, I could watch them myself, all going to kill left, right, and centre. And I shouted to this corporal. I said, "Try and make a run, Bill, and get it back here if I can." So he decided it was the best thing he could do. So he made a run, and it was only 6 yards. And as soon as he got to the corner of the building, he was hit in the back. And we got these bandages on all like that, filled bandages out and tried to stem it, but he died 20 minutes later. And of course, and at that time, even the casualties didn't get back because the aircraft had bombed it, and you know, they're from rim to rim. You know, there were that many bombs put down. And they were all 10, 12, 14 foot deep. So you couldn't get nothing. So until bulldozers came through to make a path. And the MO, he got his arm blown off. Two or three ambulance, stretcher bearers, they got wounded as well. And it was a real tragedy, that. And anyway, they got either one or two companies across the railway, but they were so badly machine gunned and badly mauled, they were driven back over into the into our side of the railway. In the meantime, I think it was the second or third day, the casualties must have been enormous for the Germans as well, because a German sergeant, he came down waving a white handkerchief. And they contacted one of the NCOs. Could he arrange for the ceasefire? So he in turn saw the padre, our padre, called him Wilson, Mr. Wilson, Padre Wilson. And they arranged with the Germans to pick the lads that were badly wounded and were dead. And that they were on the elder fire, but they couldn't stop the artillery. They stopped the small arms fire, but not the artillery.
Whose artillery?
Pardon?
Whose artillery?
Ours. With no control over the artillery. But we did negotiate for this bit of a peace, you know, while they rain, while they picked the lands up.
Did and you see the German with a white handkerchief?
Yes, it was a German sergeant. A German sergeant came down. And they're dead. And then, after that, it were usual patrol work then. you know, patrolling between companies and all that. Then I had our details with an officer to do take a job on. And he told me what he wanted to do, and he said, "I have to be with you." So he said, "I want you to up near them, that line of trees." So he up there, so it was all under German observation. So we had to do it at night. So we crawled up. It was just getting dark when we set off. And when we got there, we took the officer, myself, and what we called a getaway man. A getaway man's job was, if we were in bother, he'd turn it back and tell them what had happened. So when we got up, there's a ditch there. And when we got to the ditch where the officer said he wanted us to be for during the night, there was a dead German in there. So what happened was, this lad, a getaway man, he saw this dead German, and he got false teeth and goes, he vomited. And teeth landed on the dead German, you know. So I picked the teeth up, got him back, and the officer said, "Get back out of the way." Sent him back. Well, the officer and me were there all night. We'd only room to put a foot one foot under it in German, and another down, I crouched down like that all night, and listening. Like. And then the following morning, just as you were calling first light, we pulled back. And we were there for about 10 days. Throne never fell. When we were being pulled out, I stepped back onto this road and what were left of the battalion had severe casualties. We dropped back onto this road. As I'm going down this road, a lad steps out and he says, "Now then, Fred, how are you going on?" So I looked at him and I didn't recognise him. I says, "Who are you?" He says, "Don't you recognise me?" I says, "No." He says, "You call me George Baker." I said, "I come from Wickersley." "Now, Wickersley's only a couple of miles from here." I said, "Why that, George?" He said, "You've seen for years. He'd grown a moustache and he were in the engineers." So he said, "You've been had about time," and I said, "Ah, bloody awful." Anyway, he fell inside and watching down. And talking about this, that, and about home. And when we got about half a mile down, he says, "Fred, will you tell him you'll see him at home?" I said, "I will." "And will you do the same for me, George?" He says, "Yes." So that was it. We went back to this other place we've been before. I can't think of the name of it. And following week, I gets a letter from home saying George was killed same day.
This place is not Gonneville, is it?
Pardon?
This place is not Gonneville, is it? Gonneville, is it? Is it?
I don't want to choke it down. We were just outside Throne, and we were working our way back down, back towards Sanneville. Yeah. Yeah.
Going back to Operation Goodwood, you said that you got deafened by the morning minutes.
That's right. Still got it.
Where were you? What kind of terrain were you in when that happened?
We were coming across a field. We were in extended order. And we were coming across this field, and it must have been about a mile and a half at least from where we were as objective. And as we came over onto the forward slope, he dropped his bombs, and I think there were quite a few casualties in that company, by the way, in D Company. But just my ears had just... my ears went altogether, still not got it back.
And then you went on to attack the ridge?
That's right. Where the ridge was with the Throne. Throne was actually on the ridge. The village of Throne was on the ridge.
And you were under German machine gun fire?
Yeah.
For how long?
Oh, we went on for long enough. No, it was slaughter that. It was all amongst them. That's 152 lads were lost there.
Did you personally take any shelter anywhere?
Yes, I got behind this building that I told you about, this with cattle go in, you know, for a bit of shelter, it's a cattle shelter or whatever. And I got behind there. And another funny thing while I'm thinking about it, while we're there, one of the battalion snipers come up and he says, "I might be able to get a good view," he says, "at Germans if I get up in the top. That's in this building." So, of course, they called him, I got his name then. He got up, he'd only been a few minutes, and he jumped down. He said, "Get out of here." I said, "Why?" He says, "But he tanked here, so he's got his gun trained on, you're going to knock it down." So we moved back about 80 or 90 yards, expecting it to go, but it didn't. So we moved back in again. And we did lose a lot of land. Padre called it one of our greatest tribulations. That was Goodwood. After Goodwood, we got quite a number of reinforcements again, because we badly needed them. And we moved away from that area and went on to right flank. We've got to see the church, the Bayer churches, and there were big signs up there about dust. Because if you do fire, and there's all these big posters up, and military police here, keep the speed of your vehicles down. We went round, and then we set off. By that time, Patton, General Patton, had started his breakthrough. And we were surprised how much land had been captured. Because we'd been used to such a confined space, then we suddenly found out we'd quite a bit of land. And we set off. I can't remember quite all the other areas. We were stopped gapping and doing a bit of fighting, and then Jerry, and that, which actually led up to
Falaise?
Falaise. Up to the Falaise Gap. And we kept pushing forward and went to another place. We lost some land there at, near Veer, a place called Veer. And we put it into a tight there to clear it. It was actually a mountain, like a mountain. It was about 800 feet high, and lads were pulling to attack it. In the meantime, I were transferred from D Company back to A Company. And I suddenly found out I was acting platoon sergeant then. And when I got there, the lads had put an attack in and got beat off. So I saw the major, and he said, stop here a bit while I assess what's happening. And we were there for about an hour and a half to us, and he said, right, go down and join your platoon. He says, you're in 9th platoon now. And he said, you'll probably be acting platoon sergeant. And when I got down there, the engineers had tried to put a bridge over this river, and it scored a direct hit on them, and they killed about 15 engineers and wounded about 30 more. And every time they tried to pull a bridge up, he knocked it back down. So I thought, well, the best thing I can do is to try and ford the river to join, because the platoon which I was joining was already the other side of this stream or river, a small river it was. So I forded it, and then I had to start looking for them, and I found them about 200 yards from the slope. And I says, who's in charge? And they said, well, he's a sergeant, he's only just joined us. I said, what are they calling me? They didn't know. I said, well, how come here? I said, I'm acting platoon sergeant. I said, I'll contact to whoever's senior. Anyway, they called him Sergeant Good. And I introduced myself. He said, well, he said, we've already lost one complete platoon going up on the left-hand side. They've gone. I said, don't know where they've gone, but they disappeared. So I said, well, what's happening now? I said, we've got to stop here. I said, instructions are, we've got to stop here at this side and hold this bridge, a bit of a bridgehead. I said, oh, do that. So we're there for 2 days. And then...
Is this near Veer?
Yes, yeah. I think it was about 2 to 3 miles from Veer itself. Veer were captured by the Yanks. And from there, we were pulled out and went to a place called Fleurs. And when we nicked out at battle there, the bag, you know, the bag, shrinking bag from...
The Falaise Gap?
No, from the Falaise Gap. So that it was gradually shrinking as the Germans withdrew. And from there went to Fleurs, and then the Falaise Gap were closed, and the Germans escaped. What were left of them escaped. But they had enormous losses in that area. It's interesting to know that some of the platoon that did disappear, the bodies were found in Valley itself. They'd probably been made to go through with the Germans, and they'd lost a life. that was more or less the end of the Normandy campaign, for me anyway. We were pulled out and went to a place, from Flers, went to a place called Etrepagny. We were out of battle there for about a fortnight. The pipes and drums had